Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on a Jupiter and Mars.
Hello and welcome to Season 2, Episode 16 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us of today's topic.
You bet. Today, we are focused on the evolution of space stations, and they date back to Skylab way back in 1973, so, you know, half century ago. And today, there is, of course, the International Space Station. And that was assembly started in space, actually, in 1998, some 26 years ago. And the Chinese have an entry, which they call Tiangong, which translates as Sky Palace. So we're going to talk a little bit about the commercial plans for new space stations and look even further down the road and the potential of space stations to do more, much more, actually, in terms of human habitation off the planet. But first, Steve, I think you have an update for us.
Well, I do, Tim. And, you know, had we been doing space talks even 5 years ago, there wouldn't be the plethora of weekly updates that we're fortunate to be experiencing at this time of stellar research. Instead of searching for updates, you and I are forced to sift and pick from an almost unbelievable list of items, be they of the new rocket boosters, private ventures, moon launches, satellite probes, and last but not least, cosmological discoveries.
So what do you have for us today, Steve?
Well, you know, Tim, it's been a while since we talked about stars, so let's have a go with the giant star Capella, situated in the constellation Auriga, some 29 light years away. These evenings, it's almost right overhead, and after Arcturus and Vega, is the third brightest star in our northern hemisphere. And another stellar delight these winter months is the blue supergiant Rigel, some 860 light years away, located at the bottom of the constellation Orion. Now, the adjective supergiant is not used lightly, as Rigel is about 20 times as massive as our Sun, is 80 times its size, and is, believe it or not, some 200,000 times brighter. Rigel is expected to end its life as a supernova, leaving behind a neutron star or a black hole as its remnant. And yet, you can see Rigel with your naked eye blazing away in all its glory.
Well, the place to start this week's look at space stations is to tackle some of the fundamental aspects of what's been playing out over the past 50 years. You know, questions like, why are we doing this? Seriously, from almost the very start of the space station history, a lot of people have questioned its purpose, the money that's being spent, and wondering about what the alternatives might be. And by alternatives, I'm actually not talking about directing public funds to, I don't know, fight poverty or build bridges.
Tim, this debate has been about the value of human space exploration vis-a-vis the less costly option of sending probes. But actually, there's another debate worth mentioning here. The vast majority of actual science flowing from the investment in space stations has focused on the impact of long-duration flight on human physiology, directly related to the assumption that further exploration of space will indeed involve human exploration.
Now, we're going to wind the clock back, but not for a second or two. Let's keep in mind that whatever the merits of the International Space Station might be, the cost has been staggering. It's apparently $150 billion spent since 2010, and that doesn't include the money that was spent in the initial construction phase, which began prior to that in 1998. Now, those costs were spread out among a number of countries, including Russia, the United States of America, Japan, the European Union, and of course, Canada. But now, Steve, take us back in time.
Here we go. 1973 was notable not only for musical hits such as Long Train Running and Space Oddity, but also for NASA launching the first U.S. space station, the Skylab, into low Earth orbit atop a Saturn 1B rocket booster. Now, a key point here is that this entire station was carried as one piece and designed to orbit for a few years until it deorbited in 1979. And there's a little sidebar here. NASA was unsure of its final earthbound trajectory until it burned up over Western Australia. Now, as a circulation gimmick, the San Francisco Examiner offered a $10,000 prize to the first person to deliver a piece of Skylab debris to its office within 72 hours of its crash. Long story short, 17-year-old Stan Thornton of the tiny town of Esperance awoke when Skylab pieces pelted his house. Thinking quickly, he grabbed a few charred bits of material, hopped on a Learjet provided by a local radio station, and flew to San Francisco to claim his $10,000 prize. Incidentally, the town of Esperance issued NASA a $400 littering ticket that they never paid.
And good for them. I hadn't known that. And that, you know, interest on that $400, that could be real money now. But let's get back to the spacey stuff, as we say, Steve. So physically in space for 6 years, Skylab was crewed only three times for a total of 172 days in space. But during that relatively short life, Skylab allowed for detailed observations of the Earth and Sun, acted as a bit of a medical lab, actually, and enabled novel microgravity experiments. And it served as the first platform for studying the effects of long-duration flight. As mentioned, many experiments on the astronauts themselves were conducted to research how the human body responds to extended periods in microgravity.
We would be remiss in not mentioning that the Soviet Union actually orbited its Salyut space station 2 years earlier than Skylab in 1971 and ran a parallel, highly secret military version called Almaz, the latter having primarily a military reconnaissance mission and one flight, unmanned, also conducted tests firing cannons in space. Now, on the happier side, the evolution of space stations led to the Soviets' modular Mir space project begun in 1986, and it should be noted that although the Salyut means salute, Mir translates as peace, and soon thereafter the Cold War gave way to a welcome period of collaboration between the U.S. and Russia, with several missions involving both cosmonauts and visiting astronauts. Mir was the first continuously inhabited long-term research station in orbit and held the record for the longest continuous human presence in space at 3,644 days until surpassed by the ISS in October
2010. I understand that the longest single human spaceflight to date was on Mir with cosmonaut Valery Polyakov, spending 437 days on the station between 1994 and 1995. Now, after the Berlin Wall came down, starting in 1987, the Mir joint missions were a powerful symbol that we were moving away from the risks of a nuclear confrontation to an era of peace and collaboration.
Speaking of collaboration, Tim, in November 1988, the Soviets launched the Zara, which is Dawn in Russian, as the first module for that new International Space Station. And 2 weeks later, as planned, NASA launched STS-88, carrying a cosmonaut and five astronauts, along with a module called Unity, which was mated to Zyra and thus began the first phase of assembly for the ISS. And one proud Canadian aside here, the Canadarm was used to join Unity to Zyra, and as a bonus, a giant IMAX camera was also on board the Endeavour shuttle, so hooray for Canada.
There were three different shuttlecraft that were used for those assembly missions, the Atlantis, the Discovery, and of course, as you mentioned, the Endeavour. And altogether, there were five modules that were tacked onto the original Mir space station. There are now 15 altogether. They've increased living space, they've added additional research laboratories, and of course, they've enhanced our ability to observe the planet Earth. So when fully complete, the ISS is going to weigh about 420,000 tons, It will measure 74 meters in length and about 110 meters wide. And that, of course, is the equivalent of a football field, including the end zone. Though the ISS has been in orbit for over 25 years, let's not forget to mention some of the incredible drama that existed around the Mir program. And Steve, you know, it wasn't like the Swiss watch operating in low Earth orbit, not by a long shot.
You're right, Tim. And some of Mir's adventures reminds one of the few episodes from Lost in Space.
Well, how about a fire on board a spacecraft? Would that be okay? Well, that happened in 1997. The fire was caused by an oxygen-generating canister, and it led to a temporary loss of power and life support systems. Fortunately, the crew managed to extinguish that fire, but later the same year, while delivering the new Progress module, which was an unmanned cargo spacecraft used by the Soviet Union. There was a wee problem, Steve. During the docking phase, long story short, it crashed into Mir and punctured a hole in the new module, causing a depressurization.
Say, Tim, is this where Ron Popeil steps in and says, but wait, there's more?
He does. Mir experienced a series of computer failures in 1997 and 1998 that resulted in periods of loss of control and communication with the ground. Now, these incidents raise concerns about the reliability of Mir's aging systems. And speaking of reliability, how about, well, another pressure leak? In June 2000, a pressure leak occurred in the Zvezda module. The crew initially patched the leak with tape. They got, I don't know if it was duct tape, but patched it with tape, and it was later sealed more permanently. Now remember, the module has high pressure, and compared to the very low pressure of space, the tape works temporarily, since the air pressure is pushing the tape into the hole. While this incident didn't pose an immediate threat, the die was at that point cast, and it was time to think about bringing Mir back to Earth. Mir's operational life came to an end with an uncontrolled re-entry on March 23rd, 2001. And while the majority of the space station burned up on re-entry, some fragments did indeed reach the Earth's surface.
You know, Tim, during that re-entry phase, I was watching online and I recorded the actual altitude and the time lapse and then put it into a chart later on. You could see it skipping along the Earth's atmosphere and gradually slowing down and then suddenly plummeting. But let's not suggest it's only the Russians behaving badly with regard to their space junk. The concern is how readily countries are willing to take risks, not just hoping their spacecraft burn up and don't end up in someone's backyard like parts from a jettisoned Boeing 737 MAX 9.
Just to keep up with the times, that's right. Airplanes aside then, we can still recall that it was a Russian nuclear-powered satellite that did scatter debris on Canadian soil way back in November of 1978. It was re-entering the atmosphere where it burned up over northern Canada, depositing radionuclides.
Ah, yes, good old Cosmos 954. Well, it was a reconnaissance spy satellite, and a malfunction prevented the safe separation of its onboard nuclear reactor. Upon re-entry, it scattered radioactive debris over northern Canada, some of the debris landing in the Great Slave Lake area next to Fort Resolution. This prompted an extensive multi-year cleanup operation known as Operation Morning Light, for which the Canadian government billed the Soviet Union for $6 million under the terms of the Outer Space Treaty. The Soviets eventually paid $3 million in compensation.
Probably lucky to have seen a single dollar, I suspect, but okay, that brings us up to date. And now the era of the International Space Station. And in fact, that's had a very impressive safety record. And it's also very international. 15 countries have collaborated so far, including, well, Russia, Canada, the European Union, the United States, and a number of other countries such as Norway, Sweden, Spain, Great Britain, and Japan.
We've got lots to say about the ISS, and that's not just because of the science or the significance, but also because of the impressive role Canada has played in terms of the Canadarm and the Canadian astronauts such as Roberta Bondar and Steve McLean that have made their mark. And of course, we must mention Chris Hadfield, who did command the ISS at one point and is clearly one of the most famous Canadian astronauts in the past decade, not just in Canada, but around the world. In fact, before we go to a station break, we want to play a clip from Chris Hadfield, and it's a good one about controlling the ISS. And it's not how you think it might be.
We're on board a spaceship, but which way are we pointing? We have to control which way we're pointing because we're solar powered and we have to point our solar arrays at the sun. We have to control which way we're pointing because we want to be able to communicate with the Earth. So our antennas need to point the right way for communications with satellites. We have to control which way the space station is pointing even while we're asleep. So we have sort of like an autopilot that whatever we've set it in, it'll keep that attitude going, just like in an airliner. And we can control it as the crew while we're awake using this display right here. It can also be controlled by the folks in mission control on the ground, either from Moscow or from Houston. But how do you actually turn the space station? We have these huge spinning wheels. We call them control moment gyros or gyrodynes. And we put a little bit of torque on them. And instead of them turning, the whole space station so we can steer our space station using spinning wheels and solar power. Nice, efficient way to steer a spaceship.
And a tip of the hat to the Canadian Space Agency for providing that clip about Chris Hadfield. Now, not only was Hadfield the first Canadian to command the space station, back in 1985, young CF-18 fighter pilot Chris Hadfield flew a nighttime scramble out of Bagotville, Quebec, to intercept Russian bombers flying through Canadian airspace, and he became the first Canadian to do an intercept. He would later conduct 7 similar air intercepts, and as he later recounted, quote, "What surprised me at the time was that we couldn't tell anybody about these intercepts. It was a secret, but I couldn't figure out who we were keeping it a secret from. We were actively defending our own airspace against invading armed aircraft, but it wasn't until many years later that these incidents were made public."
Times have changed. I was just looking at Chris Hadfield's website, chrishadfield.ca. He's got new literature for sale, books that he's writing that are fictional. If you go online, you'll find an amazing number of educational videos that Hadfield's been involved in or has created. He's just an extraordinary individual in so many different ways. Now, back to the space station, though. As we were saying, it's extremely large. It's over 100 meters wide with its solar panels and about 75 meters in length. So that's large enough that it does an enormous job reflecting sunlight, making it easy for us to see it. And for those who are keen to see it for themselves, it's just a matter of getting a free app for your phone, because there are plenty of them that let you know exactly where the ISS is traveling and where it will appear in the night sky. And a good one will tell you exactly when it will appear over the horizon in the western sky and when it will be as overhead as possible, depending on your particular location. And so, as we mentioned when talking earlier about the first space stations, the research agenda hasn't actually changed very much in these past 50 years. There are still Earth studies, material studies, and solar studies, but very much central to all of this has been the homework done on the impact of microgravity on the astronauts themselves. And over those same 50 years, there's been some dramatic improvements in the science we've been using, the quality of the equipment that's been employed, and in particular, we wanted to mention the Canadarm. In fact, Steve, we've recently come across some wonderful offerings that show just how the Canadarm was used on the shuttle to assemble it and create the modern space station that we all know.
Now, the talented animator Jared Owen has made a number of superb animations, from how aircraft are built to how escalators work. And his amazing How Did They Build the ISS is the best you can find, as it richly illustrates how the Canadarm is essential to the endeavor of building the ISS.
I'm going to echo that thought, Steve. We've both seen it. And as impressive as the technology was that he's depicting, that man's ability to tell a story is extraordinary. Now, Steve, there are some common questions that astronauts get asked all the time, and they're not surprising, like, you know, how do you go to the bathroom, shall we say? Where do you sleep? How do you stay healthy? But I've got one topic that I do want to spend a bit of time on, and that's food. And here's why. Just what gets eaten in space and the implications for longer missions, it needs more attention.
Okay, I'll bite.
The fact is, eating in space is not that great. They've spent hundreds of billions of dollars altogether putting a relatively few people up there. And though the view is out of this world, the same can't be said for what they're offering. During the first Mercury flights, for example, you can actually forgive them for skipping over the finer points and just putting calories into freeze-dried offerings, like, you know, just add water and squeeze dinner out of a tube. The reason for space foods was obvious, as having crumbs floating around presents some potentially dangerous respiratory problems. I mean, just use your imagination. Inhaling a mouthful of yesterday's donut, don't want that to happen. So when the shuttle operated, the carte du jour was somewhat better. They now had the room to take up some fresh fruit and vegetables. And I've read they even found a way to let astronauts have some fancier foods, such as shrimp cocktail.
But, you know, if you signed up for months on board of the ISS, there's obviously going to be a measure of isolation to consider, and that's when astronauts might get a hankering for some real comfort food. With improvements in packaging and the benefit of past astronaut experience, nutritionists have been able to ensure astronauts are getting a better alignment of protein and foods that protect health and promote well-being. However, I suspect the odd banana or two isn't going to make astronaut Tim that happy.
No, I am not. First off, there's no French fries in space. In fact, nothing is fried or roasted. That kind of cooking could result in undesirable chemicals wafting about. And hot food? Actually, it's not even that hot, Steve. Mostly, the food is warmed through hot water injection or in a convection oven that gets things to about 75 degrees C. But there's something else I wasn't happy to read. Astronauts are finding that food tastes less flavorful in space. And the explanation seems to be the result of two factors, both related to, well, microgravity. First off, there's the movement of sinus fluids inside the astronaut's head. It's different, creating sinus pressure similar to that of experiencing a cold. And also, the smell of that tasty sandwich, well, it's not wafting up to your nose because of a microgravity environment. And the food may still be arriving out of a plastic tube that you're squeezing. And as a result, there is a widespread experience that the food tastes bland. And I've read that zesty taco sauce is so popular, people have been putting it on their cereal and even using it as a kind of currency on board the ISS. You know, I'll take your dirty chores in exchange for your share of the Tex-Mex sauce. I mean, seriously, Steve, that's what's going on.
So it's sort of like cigarettes in prison, is it?
Yeah.
Well, you've served up an easy segue here, Tim. If the next generation of space stations were a whole lot bigger and were rotating at the appropriate speed, you'd get a form of artificial gravity thanks to the induced centripetal force, which is something to perhaps savor. But okay, enough of the bad puns. The transition to a new generation of space stations is actually happening. For starters, there are private sector companies like Axiom and Vast, and that's a new one for us, that are operating for the express purpose of building and maintaining their own for-profit space stations. And as for lunar exploration, the verdict is still very much out as to whether orbiting space stations will play an important part or even the major role in housing astronauts. Axiom is a private sector player for lunar missions, but NASA is also gearing up. We've been talking about that return of human flight to the moon, recently pushed back another 8 months, unfortunately, but we haven't mentioned that part of the Artemis NASA plan, which involves a lunar orbiting space station as an integral part to getting humans back on the moon. Let's have a quick listen to former NASA astronaut and now Northrop Grumman employee Rick Mastracchio talk about this new space station.
I'm Rick Mastracchio, former NASA astronaut who flew on three space shuttle missions and a Soyuz mission, totaling 228 days of living and working on the International Space Station. I used that experience working for Northrop Grumman, where we are building the habitation and logistics outpost, known as the Halo Module. It forms the first part of NASA's Gateway. Gateway will be placed in lunar orbit to provide short-term habitation and a place for the astronauts to prepare for their mission to the lunar surface or even to Mars. On a typical lunar mission, the crew arrives from Earth, docks their Orion spacecraft to the Halo module. The crew spends a few days preparing for their mission to the moon. Once ready, they use the human landing system or the lunar lander to head down to the surface. They may spend as little as a week or many months on the surface. Upon completion of the surface mission, crew returns to the Gateway and prepares for the journey back to Earth. The Gateway and Halo provide astronauts a safe environment to live and work in lunar orbit. The Halo module has volume for the crew to sleep, exercise, prepare food, perform scientific experiments, and much more. Halo is just one of the many components of Artemis that Northrop Grumman is working on. We are developing vehicle concepts and studying cargo delivery to the Gateway and to the lunar surface. And we are studying human landing systems and even lunar rovers to greatly improve the exploration of the surface of the moon.
It's still a bit shocking to hear of this venture. You know, he wasn't talking about three astronauts in some Apollo-sized spacecraft. He was talking about astronauts spending weeks and months on the lunar surface and using the space station as both a transit stop and a possible departure point for Mars expeditions. Are we talking about space stations becoming Plan B, place where humans can live and thrive in a gravity-like environment, and one where the food tastes good?
I guess it's possible, and compared to living underground below the surface of either the Martian or lunar surface, there are some advantages. Think about something like surgery or dental work. It's not going to be a cakewalk to even stockpile requisite medical supplies and equipment. And then you'd have to operate in a low gravity environment where water and blood won't naturally flow as they do on the Earth. The notion of generations of humans living, loving, having families on the surface of either the moon or Mars is more dystopian than it is ideal.
We've mentioned that the size of the ISS is pretty impressive, but it's still only 100 meters in length. In fact, a little shorter than that. And it doesn't spin in a manner designed to generate a 1G environment. That would require a much bigger space station. And here's a starter option for just that kind of thing. Let's make that space station 900 meters in diameter and have it spin one revolution per minute. Well, that would get you that 1G, but only at the extreme edge of the station. Because as you move toward the center of the space station, the centripetal force would become less and less, and you'd experience diminishing gravity with every step.
But Tim, that's not what Hollywood has promised. But I guess the math is the math. If you increase the diameter, you're adding mass to the space station, and that's a costly endeavor. Making a smaller space station with a higher rotational speed is out of the question, as, believe it or not, your feet would experience more artificial gravity than your head would. And if nausea didn't get to you first, we haven't even talked about the Coriolis effect. If you tried to pour water out of a pitcher into a cup, the spinning motion would have that water slew sideways and miss the cup. Nothing goes in an apparent straight line.
Okay, so smaller yet faster spinning is out. So let's go big or go home. Let's say the station ends up weighing, well, a million tons. Most likely we'd be talking about fabricating this gigantic wheel with materials that would be shipped from the Earth. Currently, the maximum payload for one rocket is about 50 tons. So to construct that larger space station would require an incredible 20,000 launches. And the math is going to improve, we'll admit that, but only by so much. Elon Musk's SpaceX Starship has projected payloads of somewhere between, I think it's 100 to 150 tons, which would reduce the launches by a significant factor down to, say, 7 to 10,000. And that's for the first single prototype space station. Another means of improving the math would be to fabricate the space station, or at least part of it, with lunar materials. And 3D printing technology is going to help with that. And we know launching from the moon's 1/6G surface is a whole lot easier than shipping stuff up from planet Earth. So yeah, it's not inconceivable from a technological standpoint, but it would be a huge stretch. And we haven't even mentioned the implied cost. Where's that return on investment?
But what of the concept of cell, of cramming people into a closed environment for extended periods of time? Now, I've heard something called Biosphere 2. What's that all about, Tim?
Well, it was a bit of an experiment back in the 90s. It has a reputation now for having been a huge disaster. What we're looking at is 8 people set aside in a small location in Arizona. Hopefully they were going to spend, and in fact did spend, 2 years trying to replicate as best possible the habitat for setting up shop on another planet. So the 8 did survive the 2-year experiment in that they walked out alive, although a bit thinner. However, the materials used to create the shell of the structure itself that they were inside ended up causing problems. Some of the food choices they had made in their initial planning didn't work. And the working relationship between the 8 participants fell apart really quickly and became really toxic. Now, it's certainly true that the mission, as they called it, was a disaster, but then so was Apollo 13, you could argue, and a great deal can be learned from every disaster.
Learning about endurance space travel by flying around the Earth on board a space station in low Earth orbit constitutes a large part of the learning curve. But other lower cost aspects of survivability can be explored here on Earth.
Now, who knows where this will all lead to? I'm sure it's upward. However, that's all the time we have today on Space Talks. And until next time, this is Tim Woods.
And Stephen Lowry saying so long, and we'll see you next time on
Space Talks.
Me to the moon, let me play among the stars.